Hi, this is Nicole Hemsoth, editor of HPC Wire, here with today's edition of Soundbite, our daily interview series featuring researchers, thought leaders, and newsmakers in the world of high-performance computing. Today we'll be talking with Dr. Gil Campo, a research scientist at the University of Colorado's Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Sciences. Dr. Campo is a partner researcher at NOAA's Earth System Research Laboratory, where he is a leader on the 20th Century Reanalysis Project, which will use vast volumes of existing climate data to analyze and reanalyze weather conditions over a long period of time. Hi, Gil. Thanks for being on today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So this project has received quite a bit of attention in mainstream media, even. For those who aren't familiar, however, could you describe what this project aims to do and what the end goal is?
Sure. Nicole, what we're trying to do is recreate the weather map from today back to the 19th century. And we're trying to get that weather map at the surface, like you'd see on the Weather Channel, all the way to the level of the jet stream. And we want to have that map every, in our case, 6 hours over a network of grid points around the world. And going back, we specifically go back to 1871 right now, and we're trying to go back further. And we're recreating the pressure, the temperature, the winds, the humidity, the clouds, even the ozone distribution as we take observations and combine them with our guesses at that weather map. And that's where the high-performance computing comes in.
I see. And just a quick question. I mean, back in the late 1800s, there weren't sophisticated grid points that were feeding into large systems. So you're dealing, obviously, with just general written text data, and then moving up, you get more and more sophisticated instrumentation. That would mean you'd have a lot of different data types to deal with. Is that so?
Well, that's the way it's been done in the past. That's not the way that we do it. In our approach, we only use barometric pressure observations. So the barometer was invented in the 17th century by Torricelli, and by the middle of the 19th century or so, most of its problems had been worked out. And so we are relying on the barometer and its consistency throughout time. So even in the 21st century, where we do have many satellites and weather balloons and aircraft data, we ignore all of that data to try to keep our reconstruction as homogeneous as possible.
Right, right. Oh, that's very interesting. So barometric pressure is sort of the litmus test for what the weather was actually like. Huh?
That's right. And so it goes back to a captain of a ship would know that there's a problem coming because the glass is falling. The barometric pressure is dropping. And we rely on the very regular measurements of pressure that were made on board ships and from stations around the world. And all those have been, many of them have been collected and were preserved and archived. And our colleagues around the world are getting those observations out of archives, off the paper, digitizing them, and then making them available to us and to the whole scientific community. In fact, just doing that part, rescuing the data, has been a major effort and also involves a lot of computation. We have a citizen science project called oldweather.org, where anyone can go and join one of the ships in the fleet that are currently being recovered. Right now, they're doing ships from the U.S. Navy.
Wow, that is very exciting. You've just given me a way to kill the rest of my afternoon. Thanks a lot for that.
You bet. It is very addictive and really fun. You get to not only recover the weather data that we need, but also to get the excitement of what's happening aboard the ship from their tweets. They have geolocation tags and then about 160 to 180 characters saying what's going on the ship at that time.
Mm-hmm. That's incredible. How many people are working on this at any given time? Do you have any sense of the scale of this? I know it's a global effort, right?
So oldweather.org itself has something like 20,000 registered users, I think, and I couldn't tell you how many are on at any one time. But often when oldweather.org has gotten some media attention, that number spikes into the thousands.
Well, let's hope that we help old weather today with this podcast. So let's move into some of the computational needs of what you're doing there. Can you give us a sense of, A, how much data it is that you're dealing with? I mean, you said you're running this every 6 hours, which I know is compute and probably data intensive. Give us a sense of the environment and the challenges.
Sure. So we run this on the U.S. Department of Energy NERSC supercomputers, and right now we're using Hopper. Let's imagine trying to make just one map at one time. So say we want to know the weather on January 1st, 1900, around the world at 0Z. Then what we do is we have a numerical model that represents our understanding of the equations of the weather. And it's the same numerical model that makes the weather prediction by the National Weather Service of the United States. We're not able to use it at the same spatial resolution that they would. So we have the grid around the world divided up about every 2 degrees of latitude by longitude. And then we have about 28 levels in the vertical representing the troposphere that we're all familiar with where the weather is, and the stratosphere, where, say, most of the ozone is and the layer that protects us from the sun. So we have this coded up, and we're going to run a numerical simulation of what was happening over a six-hour period in early 1900. And we don't think we know the weather that well, so we're going to run that simulation, in our case, 56 times. So we'll have 56 guesses as what was happening to the weather at the time we want, January 1st, 1900, 0Z. So we'll take our 56 guesses, and let's see, you like the details. So that took 336 cores on Hopper to run one of these guesses, and it takes about 4 minutes of real wall clock time to represent the 6 hours that we want to simulate. That we want to reconstruct. And then we'll spend another 2 to 4 minutes combining those guesses with all of the barometric pressure observations. And that's what makes this not just a simulation, but actually a reconstruction of what the weather actually was. So if we have a guess that you have a weather map, that we have 56 weather maps, and maybe in some of them, low pressure moving up the U.S. East Coast is coming quickly, and in some of them it's coming slowly. And then we have an observation of pressure, say, off of Cape Hatteras in North Carolina. And it says that the pressure is lower than the mean of our guesses. Then all of the guesses are going to come closer together and reduce their pressure near the observation in North Carolina, but because the guesses have a covariance among them, we can adjust the pressure all and the winds and the temperatures in a physically consistent way to reflect that observation. And then we'll look at an observation, say, in Washington, D.C., and then another one in Atlanta and observations off the coast, and we'll combine all of them to make the best estimate, to make the guesses as close together as possible on what was actually happening at that time.
Wow, that's incredible. And again, it sounds very familiar if you know a little bit about weather forecasting systems and how those applications run. But then you have the added complexity, right, of taking all this data and then meshing it with even longer periods of time. So what about that component?
So one of the problems that you bring up is what happens as the barometers move around, for instance. That's one of the problems we have of trying to make not just the weather map for today, where if we use our technique, we really know the answer because we can compare our reconstructions that are only using the barometric pressure to the actual weather maps, what we call the analysis that the National Weather Service is making, where they've used millions of observations from satellites and aircraft and weather balloons, as well as these barometric pressure observations and wind observations, all kinds of meteorological observations. So if we want to have this be as homogeneous as possible, we need to take into account how the barometric pressure instruments are changing and if they have any problems. And one of the ways we do that is our algorithm will include that each observation is checked by all of the neighboring observations within 1,000 kilometers of it. And if we find that one is systematically different, we'll do a correction to that observation so that it becomes more consistent with its so-called buddies.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the application that you're using here, this is a mesh then of several different applications and algorithms. You've had to glue all these components together, I would imagine.
That's right. So the main application, one part of it is the weather forecast model. So that numerical model is coming from the National Centers for Environmental Prediction of NOAA, and that's a model that they had developed already to be able to make the weather forecasts. And we use it at lower spatial resolution than they would, but we need to run it for 130-odd years, and they need to run it for the next 6 to 12 hours to make an analysis, and then they run it in simulation mode to make the forecast that we see. So that's one application. The other application is the algorithm that's going to combine those forecasts with the observations, and that's called data assimilation. And that was done by my colleagues Jeff Whitaker and Tom Hamill here at NOAA.
Right, and the assimilation component, and I've talked to a few weather centers. This is one of the big key challenges. This is where a lot of the secret sauce, if you will, lies. I mean, what's involved there? How long did it take them to develop this? It's important stuff.
So the particular algorithm that Jeff and Tom developed is one implementation of what we call an ensemble common filter, and the ensemble aspect is what I was describing to you, where we're not going to just make one guess, we're going to make 56 guesses. And so we can have a mean of those guesses and a covariance among them. And the special sauce is that covariance tells us how much to weight a particular observation compared to all the other observations at that time and the time history of observations beforehand. And they've been working on this, and I've been working with them for more than a decade to develop this particular algorithm. Weather centers have used other algorithms, and this one is pretty competitive with the ones that are used more widely to actually make the forecast. And actually recently, our National Weather Service just implemented a hybrid ensemble common filter combined with their more traditional way of making the weather forecast analysis step.
So let's move back into the system side of things. You said that your application is running on 336 cores. Did you top out there because of scalability? Could you run on more cores? Have you used other systems?
So we top out there because it ends up being on Hopper a sweet spot for our application to be running one time. But what we didn't talk about is that we can be massively parallel across time. So we'll be using, to do one time, we'll be using 336 cores, but we'll do 35 times simultaneously. So we actually are using more than 11,000 cores at once. Then we start to hit, to make all those weather maps at once, then we start to hit problems with I/O.
Okay, I see. And you've just run this on Hopper. Are you looking at other systems or at least benchmarking?
So we've also run it on Jaguar, which is a really similar system at Oak Ridge. And actually, that's where we produced the late 19th century part of this data set. The whole data set goes from right now from 1871 to 2012, every 6 hours. So we've produced most of it at NERSC and part of it on Jaguar. Mm-hmm. We also had benchmarked it here on the NOAA JET computer and got pretty similar results. What we're more interested in now is actually trying to move to a higher resolution system. We have a lot of high resolution for our application. So the mesh that I described to you was about 2 degrees latitude by longitude and has 28 levels in the vertical. And we're going to move to better than 1 degree latitude longitude and 64 levels in the vertical. So that's a factor of about 8 times. And doing that by trying to do more science, we can use many more processors. So it goes up by at least a factor of 5. on how many cores we can use. And it should scale even more than that. But we haven't done a whole lot of testing with scaling beyond about 50,000 cores.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not quite sure if GPUs or other acceleration techniques would work for what you're doing or be useful. Have you explored that at all? Is that a viable option?
It should be a viable option. So NSEP is looking at having parts of the computation for the model first guess for that forecast or simulation, having part of that be offloaded to GPUs. And actually here at Earth System Research Laboratory, some of the world experts on porting global numerical weather prediction models to GPUs happen to sit just a few doors down from me. And they're very interested in making the models that we use to make the weather forecast and what we use for this reanalysis work on the GPUs or accelerators. So it's definitely possible, but we haven't looked at it for our specific problem.
So let's move back to the data side. We talked a little bit about the assimilation process, but just give us a sense of what sizes of data we're talking about here, what your data volumes look like, and what some of the challenges are in terms of moving that data, handling it, managing it. I'm sure there are lots of things you could say about that.
Yeah, actually the big data aspect of this is increasingly a problem. So the 20th century reanalysis version 2 that we've completed that goes from 1871 to 2012 every 6 hours at the 2 degree latitude, longitude, and 28 levels in the vertical, that complete data set representing the winds and the temperature, the humidity, the pressure, that is about 250 terabytes. And it's currently completely stored on NERSC high performance storage system on their tapes. And then the British Atmospheric Data Center has a partial copy of it, and the National Center for Atmospheric Research has a partial copy of it. And just mm-hmm. moving those data volumes around is a real challenge and remains a challenge. It can take a user several weeks to try to download what they want if they want to get to all of the 56 guesses, as opposed to using the mean and the standard deviation. When we go to version 3, what we're testing now, because of that higher resolution, it's going to be something more like a petabyte. And so using innovative ways to move those data around, like globus.org, is going to be really important for how to make data available to the climate and weather community and the general community that's interested in how has weather been changing over the past century and a half.
Especially if we're talking about tape. So you said a lot of this goes directly onto tape, but getting it off and on can be oftentimes a little bit time heavy, take some time. So how do you get around that and manage that?
So we put a subset of the most requested variables on disk. The other thing is that I've been really pleasantly surprised by how fast the high-performance storage system is at NERSC. And we have users that have written me to say that the bottleneck is not getting it off of tape. The bottleneck is the internet itself, getting the data from NERSC to their location. The other, but you just can't beat having it on disk. But we can't store this much data in the different kinds of ways that users want it on disk.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's a big challenge for, I think, lots of folks at some of these research centers. Well, Dr. Gil Campo, thank you so much for taking time today to talk about this exciting project. We'll definitely keep tabs on it and hopefully check in with you at supercomputing time.
That would be great. Thank you very much.
And thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back tomorrow. Take care.